This is The Book in the Spade, a report on the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology. Here's your host, Gordon Govier.
In the 38 years of doing the Book in the Spade radio program, I have a number of favorites among the more than 300 archaeologists and Bible scholars I've interviewed. And near the top of the list is Jody Magnus, who is Keenan Distinguished Professor for Teaching Excellence in Early Judaism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I was glad to learn that she's in Madison this semester at the University of Wisconsin as a fellow at the Institute for Research in the Humanities. In October, she'll be presenting a lecture for the Madison Biblical Archaeology Society at Upper House on campus. Upper House invited me to interview Jody on their Upwards podcast, so we had an extensive and wide-ranging conversation about biblical archaeology. Following is a portion of that interview, starting with her answer to the question, why did you decide to be an archaeologist?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me back, Gordon. And I am spending the semester here in Madison, and I am absolutely loving it. It's just such a wonderful city. I decided that I wanted to be an archaeologist when I was 12 years old. And that was thanks to a constellation of things. I had a seventh grade history teacher who was very good, and we learned about the ancient world, and I fell in love with ancient Greece and particularly ancient Athens. And ever since then, my interest has been focused on the classical world. And about the same time, I was going to Girl Scout camp and finding fossils of shells. And I had the usual childhood fascination with dinosaurs. Anyway, it all just sort of came together, and I decided I wanted to be an archaeologist. And that was it. Ever since then, I wanted to be an archaeologist.
Did you grow up in Israel?
No, I didn't exactly. I am from the U.S. I'm actually a third-generation Philadelphian, proud to say. But when I was 15, the summer I was 15, I went to Israel on a summer tour, and I fell in love with it and decided I wanted to go back and finish high school there. And I spent my 11th grade year persuading my parents to let me do it and also finding what I thought was an appropriate program. So I ended up going to Israel when I was 16 and finishing high school there, and then just stayed and did my undergraduate degree. So I guess part of my growing up was in Israel, but the latter part of my youth, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
You got your bachelor's degree at Hebrew University then in Israel, and your PhD back at the University of Pennsylvania.
That's right.
And in between, you spent 3 years as a field guide and naturalist at En Gedi, a tropical oasis on the western shore of the Dead Sea. What did you take away from your time at En Gedi?
Yeah, that is, I'm so glad you asked, because people don't usually ask me about that experience, but it was really important. One of the things that happened when I was an undergraduate in Israel that I realized studying archaeology was that our professors would talk about different archaeological sites around the country, and most of my classmates were familiar with those sites because growing up in Israel, they had taken school field trips and other kinds of field trips, and they were pretty intimately familiar with the country. And I, of course, was not. And so one of the things that I really felt I lacked when I finished my BA was that kind of intimate knowledge of the land of Israel, what's called in Hebrew Yediat Haaretz. I decided after I finished my BA that I wanted to stay in Israel and that the best way to get that kind of intimate familiarity with the country would be to work as a field guide and naturalist at a field school. So here I have to explain what field schools are, because we don't have anything like this in the U.S. So in Israel, there is a private organization called the Society for the Protection of Nature in Israel, which is somewhat analogous to the Sierra Club in the U.S., but not exactly. And they run things called field schools around the country in different parts of the country, where there is a permanent staff of guides whose job it is to take groups on hikes and nature walks around the area, that particular area. Most of the guides are either doing that work as part of their military service. So if you're very fortunate in Israel, you can do that for your military service, or they're doing it immediately post-military service. I wanted to do it, but I fell into neither of those categories. And it just so happened that at the time I was looking to join a field school, to find a position at a field school, the director, the head of the En Gedi Field School, was looking for an archaeologist for their staff, and I had just finished my BA in archaeology. So I was very fortunate that he basically hired me onto the staff of guides, and I worked there for 3 years. En Gedi is I think the oldest, if not the oldest, certainly one of the oldest field schools in Israel. It's an amazing place, the most beautiful place in the world, I think. And of course, the area that we covered, which was the western shore of the Dead Sea, included sites like Qumran and Masada and lots of other archaeological sites. And it's just, in terms of the natural beauty, it's just a spectacular area. So I spent three very, very happy years there from 1977 to 1980. Working as a field guide and naturalist. And I don't know if I can say I have that kind of familiarity with the entire country, but certainly with the area around the Dead Sea, I gained a very intimate familiarity.
You're listening to an excerpt of my Upwards podcast interview with Jody Magnus, immediate past president of the Archaeological Institute of America.
The Bible talks about David retreating to En Gedi.
Right.
I don't know if it was for 3 years or not, but some similarities there.
That's right. Well, and there are all sorts of legends, I guess they are, associated with David in the area. Of course, even if the biblical account is true or accurate, which we don't know, but even if it is, that sort of thing would leave no visible remains in the archaeological record, right? So, if he simply hid out in the area. But it's true that the Judean desert was used throughout history as a place of refuge because it is so close to Jerusalem. People looking for refuge would flee, and it's a very rugged landscape with lots of natural caves. So it was a good place for people to hide out. And so that story of David, even if it's not true, makes sense in a historical context.
And there is some archaeology at En Gedi. I think there's some prehistoric sites, but also a synagogue that was excavated many years ago. And in recent years, some texts that were excavated and put away because they were burnt beyond recognition have been finally read by a professor at the University of Kentucky who spoke here a few years ago.
There's a story about that, actually. En Gedi is an oasis, which you mentioned, and it's like Jericho in that regard. So they're both oases in the Judean desert with perennial sources of fresh water. And that's what makes En Gedi so spectacular, the rugged landscape, the lush vegetation in the middle of the desert. You don't have fresh water like that in the middle of the desert and let it go to waste. So throughout history, En Gedi has attracted settlement. There was, of course, in antiquity then a settlement at En Gedi, which was a fairly prosperous village that was based on the cultivation of exotic kinds of tropical plants, particularly in antiquity, something called the opobalsam, which was used to produce a very costly kind of perfume. There's a biblical tell at En Gedi, which was excavated back in the 1960s, but then also as part of the ancient village from a later period than the biblical tell, from the ancient village of the Roman and Byzantine periods, we do have this synagogue building, which is a small synagogue building. It's a modest building, but has a very interesting mosaic floor with the second longest inscription found so far in any mosaic floor of any synagogue. Those excavations were conducted in the early 1970s by a team of archaeologists from the Hebrew University led by the late Professor Dan Barag. One of the things that they discovered was in the destruction level of the synagogue, which was a destruction level that showed signs of burning, they found a burnt scroll near the Torah shrine. That scroll was missing for decades. I actually looked for it during my time in Israel. It was missing for a very long time. After Dan Barag's death, it resurfaced, and it has now been read, and it turns out to be at least part of the Book of Leviticus, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
I guess it's been dated on scientific grounds to the 2nd century AD, but the destruction level dates to the early 7th century AD. So it shows that these scrolls, and this is still true today of Torah scrolls, right? They're used for centuries after they're written. Anyway, yes, there is a very interesting story about that particular scroll. It's the only ancient Torah scroll that's ever been found in any ancient synagogue anywhere.
After finding out about that research and the lecture here at Upper House, I was able to visit the synagogue on my next time in Israel. And it was just amazing to see where all that took place.
Mm-hmm.
We've been doing a series of programs on seals and seal impressions and wet sifting recently.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier this year, I reviewed some of the news digest in the biblical archaeology magazine that I edit, Artifacts. And I noticed few reports about discoveries of seals and seal impressions up to 2005. Then almost every year after that, there's been at least one, often with names of people we know from the Bible. And the Temple Mount Sifting Project was involved in almost all of these, and that began about 2005. And these seals are some of the few examples we have of ancient Hebrew inscriptions. Should more excavations be using wet sifting?
It depends on the context. So one of the things that you have to understand is that, and I'd say this as somebody who directs an excavation, it's a matter of how you allocate your resources. Wet sifting is great because it retrieves these kinds of teeny little artifacts like you're describing that you wouldn't necessarily find otherwise, but it absorbs a huge amount of resources. And so you need to have a lot of funding in order to be able to, and manpower and equipment to be able to do that. And it's not necessarily always something that is worthwhile depending on what you're digging through. So it depends on the context. If you're digging in a context like, for example, this pool that was excavated by the Gihon Spring where they also wet sifted, they found a lot of these seals or sealings actually, then I think it makes sense. But if you're just excavating, I don't know, a late medieval fill from, you know, that accumulated after, I don't know, whatever, it doesn't necessarily make sense because then you're not going to, you have to allocate your resources in a wise way and you have to decide how to excavate. And so I think that what you're seeing now is archaeologists recognizing that in certain contexts, yes, it does make sense to wet sift. And depending on where you're excavating, you might want to do some tests first and wet sift and see what you come up with and then decide, do I want to allocate more resources and expand it? I say this because, you know, in my synagogue at Hukok, we're not wet sifting, but although we're doing flotation, which actually retrieves some of this stuff, but we are dry sifting all of the fills that we're finding above our synagogue mosaic floor, which were sealed by a late medieval floor. And these are fills that are a meter deep in a building that measures, 15 by 20 meters. I mean, it's a huge amount of fill and it really slows up the project, but in terms of my priorities, it's extremely important because one of my priorities is dating our building and finding things like coins and other objects in the fills. It's something that you might not come up with if you weren't doing the sifting. So it's a matter of how you're allocating your resources. And that's one of the things that archaeologists have to do in the field is decide what is the nature of the remains and what is the best way to retrieve the maximum amount of data. So that's what I would say. And I think that that's why you're seeing more wet sifting now, at least in certain contexts, but it's not something that would be suitable for everything that you excavate.
Archaeologist Jody Magnus of the University of North Carolina weighs in on the topic of wet sifting, something we've discussed at length on this program in recent weeks. Jody Magnus is in Madison this semester and will be presenting a lecture on her excavations at the Synagogue of Hukok and its beautiful mosaics coming up on October 23rd at Upper House on the University of Wisconsin campus. We have a link to all of the details on our website at radioscribe.com. This conversation is courtesy of Upper House and their Upwards podcast. We'll have more excerpts from that conversation in our next program. At our website, you can also find details of our Holy Land tours coming up in 2022, one to Israel and one to Greece and Turkey. And you can also find out how to subscribe to Artifacts, our quarterly biblical archaeology news magazine. That's all at our website at radioscribe.com. I'm Gordon Govier. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next time for more Backgrounders on the Bible through Biblical Archaeology on The Book and the Spade.
The Book and the Spade is produced by Scribe Media. For information on Biblical Archaeology resources or obtaining a copy of this program on CD, go to our website at radioscribe.com.